So hello and welcome to another episode of the Poetry Pause podcast. And in this episode, we are going to be looking at Edward Thomas. Massive poet, in a way.
Yeah.
What do you reckon, Emma, to him?
Well, I think that he's been hugely influential on lots of poets, and I can't believe that how little notice I've taken of him in the past. It's been a bit of a revelation for me.
Has it?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Now, this has got the lot, his story, actually, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's got themes of depression, infidelity, possibly entrapment in family life for a creative soul, and going against the norms. Mm. And he was often described as the delicate poet.
Mm.
So should we start with his biography and then quickly get into some of the poems? I think he offers those of us who want to write better poetry and get inspiration a huge amount of stuff, actually. So,
so
what do we know about his life?
His parents were both Welsh, but he spent his whole life in and around London, so it's interesting from that point of view. He's kind of in two camps. Some people think of him as a Welsh poet, some people think of him as an English poet.
Yeah, he's sometimes described as Anglo-Welsh, isn't he? But like the sort of Anglo-Irish poets.
And he was educated at Oxford, so he had good access to education. And he went to grammar school and things. So he's quite formally educated.
Yes. He was born in 1878, wasn't he? And his father and mother were Welsh.
Yeah.
I think his dad worked at the Board of Trade, but his dad was from Tredegar originally. And very stern and aspiring, I think.
Yeah.
And I read somewhere that his dad used to walk across Wandsworth Common with David Lloyd George. He was a great fan of his.
Mm.
And obviously had moved up socially quite a lot. And Edward was the eldest of six, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Six boys. There's a story that comes up a lot, because his relationship with his father is an interesting one, particularly in the light of his subsequent relationship with his son, I think, that Edward was running a race at school. He was in St. Paul's for a while, but he didn't last there.
Mm.
And he was, I think it was a walking race, and he was winning, and he stopped before the winning line. And this was taken as a sort of terrible act of cowardice, that he couldn't cope with kind of competing, and held up against him for years afterwards.
Yeah.
So the great thing about his life is how well documented it seems to be in terms of diaries and journals and other people
letters,
commenting.
Yeah.
And his school report said, "I wish he were a more sociable person, and I wish he seemed to take more interest in life generally."
Yeah.
So he was clearly an introvert, wasn't he? So what else do we know about him? He started writing quite young, didn't he?
He did, and wrote lots of literary criticism and prose writing.
Yeah.
But it says that most of his, or all of his poetry was written in less than 3 years, which is really interesting.
Yes.
Because I'd say he's primarily known as a poet.
Yes.
Now,
I think quite a lot of what subsequently became poetry was written in prose beforehand, wasn't it? And we're going to look at that in greater detail a bit later on. But I came across, there's a Edward Thomas Fellowship organisation where they organise walks in tribute to him and have events and all sorts of things going on. So he's got a dedicated gang of fans, definitely. And they've got the opening to The Woodland Life, which was one of about 30 significant publications that he did, far more in prose than not.
Yeah.
So he wrote this when he was 19. "At length, the road emerges from its groove onto the hilltop, and once more it is level and bounded by narrow woods of spruce, whence comes the startling challenge of the pheasant cocks. Meanwhile, the twilight air has become keener and the wind rises, humming through the green firs. The smaller birds are nearly all in cover, and only a belated pipit or a steady flapping rook moves aloft in the rude air." And there's such appreciation for the sort of sound of the words there, and it's very clean and modern sounding, yeah. actually.
Yeah.
Considering he was doing that 1897. Mm. So, you know, he was gifted, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah.
But I think his story is of somebody who feels they really have to fight to earn a living from this gift.
Yes, yeah. And I think across his work, there's a lot of tension, and I don't know if he ever finds the solution in his own mind.
Yeah. So I thought we'd start with Adlestrop, just because everybody knows it. Mm. And on YouTube, there's a reading of this by Richard Burton.
Yes, I remember Adlestrop, the name, because one afternoon of heat, the express train drew up there unwontedly. It was late June. The steam hissed. Someone cleared his throat. No one left and no one came on the bare platform. What I saw was Adlestrop. Only the name. And willows, willow herb and grass, and meadow sweet and haycocks dry. No whit less still and lonely fair than the high cloudlets in the sky. And for that minute a blackbird sang, close by, and round him, mistier, farther and farther, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire.
What's interesting about this reading, I think, first of all, is how posh Richard Burton sounds. It's also, he reads it quite rapidly and he doesn't colour the reading particularly. Mm. So you hear the poem in a very pure form, really. Yeah. Why do you think this poem is so loved?
Well, for me, it's the simplicity of the language and the purity of the moment. I mean, I've thought about it. Is it nostalgia? Is it this idea of a moment of peace like suspended in time before war and separate from the past and anything that he has, any torment he has in his mind. But I think it's so popular because it's so easy. It's a single moment in time. It's pure joy and appreciation of a very simple, quiet stillness.
Yeah.
That I think, you know, crosses time and is as relevant as ever, so...
Yes. I love this poem, and when we first talked about doing Edward Thomas, I immediately remembered this poem. It's one of the best-loved British poems, I think.
Mm.
And it reminds me of trips on the Heart of Wales line, where you go through yeah. stations like Craven Arms mm. in the summer, and there is a really particular atmosphere, timelessness about yeah. these places and a sort of enduring quality and a charm really about them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But I think it's more than a charm as well. He's on a train, but he's travelling nowhere. He's looking very closely
yeah.
at the willows, willow herb and grass and meadow sweet. He doesn't need to elaborate on that or become no. romantic about it. He's just dropping in what is there,
yeah, yeah.
And that's
yeah.
a very interesting way of kind of grounding yourself.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite photographic, yeah. really, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's been compared, or the influence of like romantic poets such as Wordsworth and Keats have been applied to Thomas. Edna Longley has said that he developed this symbolism of nature to a point where it could reflect more intimately than ever before the psychology and situation of the individual. And I feel like we're really in his head, looking through his eyes.
Yeah, out of that window, yeah. Well, we'll come back to this poem at the end, actually, because I think there's lots for we aspiring poets to get from it. I think it's an absolute little gem. We are doing a series in this podcast on Welsh poets. So how Welsh is he? Does he deserve to be here? What do we think? It's a poem called Words, where he says, "Make me content with some sweetness from Wales, whose nightingales have no wings."
Mm.
Which is a lovely way of describing the land of song.
Yeah.
So we're all nightingales without wings here. So what do you think about his Welshness?
Well, For me, it's the kind of foot in either camp that contributes to this sense of tension in his work, because he doesn't seem to belong fully in either place. So he, for example, he will... The London pavements in 1908 he described as being as dead as though they were in a museum labelled. He's not part of that landscape fully, even though he grew up there, he was educated there, he had friends there, he belonged to a literary scene there. And he said that the countryside of southern England is hospitable, even though the people are not. You know, he doesn't feel like he fully belongs there. He's got a Welsh sensibility, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in his book, Beautiful Wales, which was a prose book, he wrote, "The water pure, the people strong, kind, intelligent, and no newspapers. The fires warm and bright and large. It is clear, as it is not a city or exuberant English county, that the world is old and troubled, and that light and warmth and fellowship are good." But he's observing that. It's like he can't place himself in it. He's looking inwards.
Yes.
So I think that's part of this sense of tension.
Yes.
Or being pulled in two directions that seems to follow through lots of his writing and in his relationships as well.
Yes,
so,
yeah, yeah. Piles of creative tension.
Yeah.
And I think, didn't he had a sort of belief that he should move out of London, really. London was not good for his health, which he was troubled by a lot, and also his sort of creative psyche needed to be closer to nature.
Yeah.
So anything else about what we like or dislike about his poetry, your sort of favourite poems of his and why you like them?
I like them all. I haven't found one that I don't like. Some particular favourites. Sewing was one of my favourites. Just again, because it's a single moment and it's not about... It describes sowing seeds. So should I read some sewing? It was a perfect day for sowing. Just as sweet and dry was the ground as tobacco dust. I tasted deep the hour between the far owl's chuckling first soft cry and the first star. A long stretched hour it was. Nothing undone remained. The early seeds all safely sown. And now, hark at the rain, windless and light. Half a kiss, half a tear. Saying good night.
Oh, it's really good rhythm in there, like the sewing, isn't it?
Yeah. And to me, just the act of sowing these seeds, rather than this poem isn't about what blooms or what is achieved. It's about the act of putting in the effort.
Yeah.
I just think it's an amazing poem.
Yeah, he's the master of in the moment poems, really, isn't he? That's the sort of essence of a lot of poetry, which is that you just capture a moment that other people can identify with and have experienced, and there's a kind of universality about it, really. Yeah. Any others you like?
There's one called Tall Nettles, which I also love. It's very short.
Yeah.
Tall nettles cover up, as they have done these many springs, the rusty harrow, the plough, long worn out, and the roller made of stone. Only the elm butt tops the nettles now. This corner of the farmyard I like most, as well as any bloom upon a flower. I like the dust on the nettles, never lost, except to prove the sweetness of a shower. Again, I imagine him in a little corner where nobody goes, just looking closely at something that others might not show any interest in or even notice.
And finding poetry in it.
Yeah. Okay, have you any favourites, Pippa?
Well, rain is a great theme of his and is, of course, a great theme in Wales.
Yes, and so, it appears in both of those poems I just read as well.
Yeah, it does. You know, rain is everywhere for Edward.
Yeah.
There are two rain poems that specifically have rain in the title, and I know you've picked one.
Yeah.
So I chose the other, funnily enough. And the one I like is It Rains by Edward Thomas, and I'll tell you why at the end of it.
Okay.
It rains and nothing stirs within the fence, anywhere through the orchard's untrodden, dense forest of parsley. The great diamonds of rain on the grass blades there is none to break, or the fallen petals further down to shake. And I am nearly as happy as possible to search the wilderness in vain, though well, to think of two walking, kissing there, drenched, yet forgetting the kisses of the rain, sad too to think that never, never again, unless alone, so happy shall I walk in the rain. When I turn away on its fine stalk, twilight has fined to naught the parsley flower figures, suspended still and ghostly white, the past hovering as it revisits the light. So there's mystery and uncertainty there, but it's also very filmic. You can see these kind of figures in twilight. And it's also about his, I suspect, very confused love life, which we're going to talk about in a minute. It's different from the one that you've chosen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to give that a whirl? And
I will. Rain. Midnight rain. Nothing but the wild rain on this bleak hut and solitude and me, remembering again that I shall die, and neither hear the rain nor give it thanks for washing me cleaner than I have been since I was born into this solitude. Blessed are the dead that the rain rains upon, but here I pray that none whom I once loved is dying tonight or lying still awake, solitary, listening to the rain. Either in pain or thus in sympathy, helpless among the living and the dead, like a cold water among broken reeds, myriads of broken reeds all still and stiff, like me, who have no love which this wild rain has not dissolved, except the love of death. If love it be towards what is perfect and cannot, the tempest tells me, disappoint.
Okay, now why do you love that so much?
It's just so bleak and so without hope.
Yeah.
And this kind of idea that the rain can be all things in his life, you know, across the poetry.
Yeah.
It can wash him clean.
Yeah.
It can be the embodiment of nothingness, that of starkness and hopelessness.
Yeah.
And I think it's a metaphor for his mind.
Yes. I mean, it's really interesting because he doesn't use a lot of sort of flowery metaphor or anything like that, does he?
No.
But an awful lot of repetition. So you get rain in here loads of times.
Yeah, it's relentless.
Yeah, rain, rain. Mm. Which is the sound of the rain, really. Yeah. Because he and Robert Frost were very keen on the beauty of spoken language, weren't they?
Yeah, cadences of natural speech.
Yeah, yeah, and felt that poetry should be as much about the sound and the mood it transmits as it does the actual words. So he isn't big on, I mean, he's got, in my poem, the one that I chose, It Rains, he's got great diamonds of rain.
Yeah.
But again, there's not a lot of metaphor in there.
No.
It's just rhythm and sound and feeling, really. He's very much a poet for the ear, isn't he?
Yeah. And like diamonds of rain, that's a really interesting phrase, isn't it? Because you think at first, oh, lovely, sparkly, beautiful diamonds, but also they're hard and there's an edge, isn't there?
Yeah,
it's not straightforward.
Yeah. No, they can cut you, can't they? I mean, this communion with nature, he felt it very deeply. And I also think, and other people have said this as well, that he didn't feel man was a particularly important, significant part in all this. It wasn't nature serving man. Man sort of needed to know their place in it, really. And there's a feeling, isn't there, that nature continues, really, regardless of what man is doing in some ways.
Yeah.
Very Welsh with a rain motif moving through his work. Now, let's talk a little bit about his personal life. And we're going to have to sort of ring fence this because it has got lurid aspects to it. So he had depressive tendencies, and for a while he saw somebody called Goodwin Baines, who was a pal of his, and was a doctor who got very interested in psychoanalysis, this kind of age of Freud and Jung and all those people, and tried to encourage Edward to be more self-reliant. I mean, we know about the bad relationship with his dad, but we don't know about the relationship with his mum very much. No. There's not much written about that. Where he seems very modern, I think, is he's almost like an Instagram influencer. He's very open about his mental health struggles and sort of describes them a great deal. And says things like, I'm sick of the whole idea of myself chiefly, of you and the children. Mm. I despise myself for not putting an end to it.
Yeah.
And he does set off one day, doesn't he, with a gun to kill himself, but then sort of comes back and has a cup of tea.
Yeah.
So he found family life demanding.
Mm.
He and Helen were bohemian from the outset, I think, because she got pregnant while he was at university.
Yeah.
And then they had to get married. Helen was the daughter of James Ashcroft Noble, who was his patron, really, and encouraged his reviewing. So he struggled with this sort of moodiness and introversion, and some days walked 30 or 40 miles and frequently moved out of the family home. Didn't get on well with his son, thought he was very misguided because he was interested in things like engineering. And actually the son went off to America, I think, when he was about 12, to live with Robert Frost and family when Robert Frost returned to America. So Mervyn had a funny upbringing, but seems to have been quite happy in adulthood, actually.
Yeah.
So he sorted himself out. He was married to Helen. He had a very strong friendship with Eleanor Farchan, who was a sort of literary person and hung out with the Dymock Poets, which is a gang that he was part of, and a very beautiful artist and poet called Edna Clark Hall. But Helen and Edward's relationship was very interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Because she put up with a lot of stuff, but she was also his wife. She promoted his poems very, very keenly.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Robert Frost, who had gone back to America, succeeded in getting Edward Thomas posthumously published there, which would have been a really big deal, removed a dedication to Helen, because when she wrote her books about him and their lives together, he considered her description of their sex life to be salacious and sort of depicting Edward as a sexual inadequate. And Robert Frost took offence at this, which probably was great for sales of the book.
Yeah.
So what do you make of all this?
I think the whole thing, like every relationship, is very interesting and nuanced. I can totally see a situation where a couple who are married and the wife's role in that marriage is to bring up the children and run the household, a very traditional life, is not suitable for somebody as outspoken as Helen Thomas. And to have a husband who won't play his part in that and begrudges having to earn money and in pursuit of this creative life would be very frustrating. And equally, I can see why she would be, you know, well within her rights to write whatever she wanted about her own marriage.
Yeah.
And equally, I can see why his relationship with these other women, romantic or not, just having so much in common. You know, if we look at Eleanor Farjan particularly, they both loved walking, nature, they were both writers. And with her, he found joy and humour, which was something he didn't find in his life with Helen particularly. There was always a tension between them.
Mm.
And that's almost worse than sexual infidelity, isn't it? It's like she was kind of giving her all and not, you know, finding this equal relationship.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite admirable that she admired his work so much, So maybe we shouldn't come down on her too hard for speaking out and being herself.
Yeah.
You know, if he hadn't pursued his desire or need to write poetry and express himself in that way, we wouldn't have these
amazing
body of poems.
No, no. I mean, it is interesting looking at his life because they moved to Dymock, didn't they? Mm. And some other poets moved there as well. And the Dymock poets, so that's an area in Gloucestershire village, quite near Herefordshire, were Robert Frost, Lascelles Abercrombie, Rupert Brooke, Wilfred Wilson Gibson and John Drinkwater. And Edward Thomas justified going to London once a week because he moved in these sort of critical and literary circles to a place called the Poetry Bookshop, which sounds fantastic.
Mm.
It was in Bloomsbury and was there for 13 years, actually, 1913 to 1926. Run by somebody called Harold Munro and supported by a moderate income he had. And it sold and published poetry by living poets, and readers were encouraged to browse and hang out there. And several poets actually lived there for a while, and the atmosphere was very welcoming.
Mm.
So he'd go up there once a week, obviously he could afford that, and hold court in quite a confident way, according to the description of it, and generally hang out with his literary friends. So he was hanging out with poets quite a long time before he wrote poetry, wasn't he? And one of his books was about Keats, wasn't it?
Yeah.
As well as beautiful Wales and Celtic myths and all sorts of things. So, and then Robert Frost was a tremendous influence on him, who came to the UK, moved to Dymock. In Now All Roads Lead to France, there's a lot of description of him and Robert Frost discussing how self-determining human beings can be and about how to take the right decision and live the best sort of life. And he signed up for a regiment that was called the Artists' Rifles, wasn't it? So it included painters and poets. And I expect there was quite a lot of wafting around and creating stuff related to war. But he wasn't actually a hugely anti-war poet, was he? I mean, he obviously went along with the war. Why do you think he decided to sign up?
Well, I think that, again, it's nuanced and there are many reasons. It's been inferred that the road not taken by Robert Frost kind of pushed him towards it because it was a joke inspired by how indecisive Thomas was on a walk. He couldn't decide which path to take. But again, speaking to a friend at the time who asked him why he decided to sign up, he picked up the soil in his hands and said, "For this." So nature, landscape, and the freedom to roam at will. He didn't hate Germans, he said himself. He didn't agree that one side was just and the other not. So, you know, it wasn't that kind of blind patriotism. But he also said, "The England I loved wasn't mine unless I was willing and prepared to die rather than to leave it." So, again, that's interesting. Has he something to prove? Does he have to prove his Englishness? Does he have to be one thing or the other, English or Welsh, a fighter or a pacifist who's indecisive? So I think, he's always aspiring to this idea he has to be something in particular, you know, binary. And his poetry allows him to be nuanced.
Yes, yes. Mm. So he was very driven, really, wasn't he? And driven to do the right thing and driven to express himself and to be really good at poetry.
Yeah.
And what you describe there is almost literary defending the country, isn't it? It's literary defending the soil of the nation kind of thing, which is really interesting. I don't think one poem would make a character as complex as Edward Thomas decide to go to war. I think he probably wanted to do it. And you may say, well, it was a very slow form of suicide, but and it could have been that. But, you know, he probably had quite a good idea of what the likely outcome was, because he actually was very keen to go to the front eventually. So
interesting, though, that when he finally makes a black and white decision, it's what kills him and kills his creativity, because the poems, that's the end. We don't get any more poems.
Yes. When we look at all these aspects of his life, so he's walking 30 to 40 miles a day quite often. That's a driven person's thing. And then the poems that he wrote, he was late writing these poems, and a lot of it was based on his, obviously he had reams of observation of nature and prose to base the poems on. But he wrote 143 poems in 2 years, which is pretty amazing, really. Mm. But they were built on this kind of backlog of research and observation, weren't they? Great. Okay. Shall we now do our offerings then? Emma, what have you done and why?
So I was very taken with his explanation of why he went to war, the kind of, for this, quite literally for this, the holding of the soil. And that took me on a bit of a thought journey about how, why, you know, why he may have written, or what was the drive that he so pursued his writing, his creative writing. And so I've written this poem called Just Beneath the Surface. For this, quite literally for this, a sense that things are cool down here between the nematodes. I'm all good, sheltered by the cabbage leaves, a cool being, always destined for the ground. Down here, I've no need to grow, but I'm fed. Often I do nothing but answer to the earthworms. I'll rise only when I choose to, poke through, bloom to greet the bees and nothing more.
Fantastic. What are you, a seed?
A being, an unknown being.
Being and a being. Yeah. Fantastic. I love that. What I think is very Thomasian is your use. It's very conversational, and it's, you know, it's very plain speech, apart from, how do you say it, nematodes?
Nematodes.
Nematodes. Now, what's a nematode?
They're little invisible things in the soil doing their thing, being
nematodes,
just being
fantastic. It's very good, it's lovely and funny, and a very good tribute to Edward Thomas.
Thank you. Shall we hear yours, Pippa?
Yes. Now I better tell you about this one. So I have been doing, you know, I'm always trying to improve myself by going on endless poetry courses, which I don't know how effective they are, but I went on one where we had to do prose poems, despite not being very clear what these were. So I wrote this poem completely without any punctuation, just capitals for the sections, which you could hear. And then I did it in the poetry stanza group I go to, which I find incredibly helpful at the moment. And I just love it and think it's really what poetry's about. So a bit like Edward in the poetry bookshop, I'm into all that sort of stuff, you know, lots of feedback and things. And they generally said, great poem, but it needs laying out more as a poem. So that's what I've done here, which I don't know why I've said all this, because of course you can't see it, but I'll read it as more as it's laid out. And it's a poem where I was really going for the sound to mean something rather than other meaning from the words. So. Oak. Spring. An urgent brothel brain of lowbrow hardness, of lobe and frill, of stormcock and great tit, of swelling in the bud, of never mind your knock knees, of carved initials and copulation, of male tassel to female spire, of ring your bell, master of the cops. Druid. Your mind split, you became bird, and your rancid wound spilt from my branch to be drunk by Black Taylor's sow. Then your 90 hardships and 2 white bulls killed then, flailed with mistletoe. So you free then, Llai Llaw Gyffus, by a dderwen fawr, a hen dderwen, a dderwen crieve, and you freed by druid hater of lies and cowardice. Tory Party logo. Those shysters, those hucksters, those porn-eating mucksters appropriated me with gall, but I still have gall and am less tall than spreading, yet more likely to be struck by lightning than the crack. So that's three manifestations of oak there.
Amazing. And I love, it's a kind of a cycle as well, like you can start again at
yes.
that point. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very experimental.
No, I love it.
But
I love it. The sound really comes through when you're reading it as well, just that how it, you can let it flow over you. It's just, okay. Yeah, love it. You're the only person I can think of who would link oak and spring to the Tory party logo.
Well, it is an oak.
Oh,
the Tory
is it?
Party logo. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I have to tell everybody that. So it's obviously a bit of a limitation on the poem. But yes, the Tory party logo is an oak. So this oak is really annoyed that the Tory party has taken it as
right,
its
yes.
logo. But don't worry, because everybody I've read the poem to doesn't know this, so it obviously needs to be spelled out in some way. But yeah, I think I'll probably need illustrations, this poem, definitely.
How interesting, though, because I can feel the kind of the two parts of Edward Thomas's life as well, you know, this one foot in London, one foot deep in the country and deep in the Welsh language as well, like, you know, the Welshness of it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And how it moves in that cycle.
Yeah. Great. Now, what is his legacy then?
Well, W.H. Auden considered Thomas as a contemporary poet who he had little or no hope of ever equalling. That's quite a thing, isn't
yes.
it? That's quite a legacy.
Yeah.
But I think his legacy is that you see his influence through all kinds of contemporary poetry, and poetry since his death as well, you know, the obvious ones like Ted Hughes,
yeah.
Even Mary Oliver, really, I think. And it's you can't label him, a war poet or a nature poet. He's himself, his work is his own, and it feeds into everybody else's work. So.
Yes, yes. So he ended up really being a very profound influence, didn't he? Andrew Motion said he nominated Old Man by Edward Thomas as one of his favourite poems, saying, because it so brilliantly proves, as do all his poems, that you can speak softly and yet let your voice carry a long way. If you've got any favourite Edward Thomas poems or anything you'd like to say about him, then please let us know through our social media channels. There's lots of links to videos on YouTube and books on the website. So thanks a lot and hope to communicate with you again in the next episode of the Poetry Pause podcast. Thanks a lot. Bye from me and bye from Emma.
Bye.
Including Wilfred Owen, Wilfred Wilson Gibson and Robert Frost.